Welcome to the GeoMob Podcast, where we discuss geo-innovation in any and all forms, whether for fun or profit.
Welcome to another GeoMob Podcast. This afternoon, it's my great pleasure to welcome Quintin Lake to the GeoMob Podcast. Quintin is a multi-award-winning photographer specializing in landscape and architecture. He's a fellow of the Royal Geographical Society and the Royal Society of Arts, and his work has been featured in leading publications such as National Geographic. On Friday the 17th of April 2015, that's 10 years ago in case you need to do a little bit of counting, Quintin set off from the steps of St Paul's Cathedral in London on a five-year journey. It would take him around the entire coastland of mainland Britain. He was carrying 20 kilos of hiking gear and photography gear, and he walked 11,000 kilometres in 450 days. And if you're thinking 450 days is not a five-year journey, we'll explain later. In August 2020, when we had only recently started the podcast and were struggling in the midst of COVID, I had the pleasure of chatting with Quintin on the podcast. He was just preparing for the final sections of his epic walk around England, and that led to his book, Perimeter, which is about to be published on May the 15th. And I'm really delighted that we've got Quintin back on the podcast to talk to us about this epic walk and this stunning book. And I have to say, before we start, Quintin sent me a PDF preview of the book. I think it was the final version of the book, but in PDF form. And quite often, if someone sends me a preview in PDF, I'm delighted and I can read it, scan through it, or whatever. On this occasion, I want to declare immediately that the day the book is published, I'll be ordering the actual book because it's just the most exquisite, exquisite piece of publication, and I want to have a copy. And I think by the end of this podcast, you too may want to have a copy. So, Quintin, welcome to the GeoMob Podcast.
Hi, Stephen. It's great to talk to you again.
Thanks. So let's start by recapping your epic journey for anybody who didn't listen to the August 2020 episode. It really was mainland Britain, the whole shebang, England, Scotland and Wales?
That's right, yes. So it was the closest I could physically stick to the coastline in England, Wales and Scotland on the mainland. And I would like cross the first bridge across the big estuaries like the Humber and the Severn. I'd have to detour around military sites and industrial areas. But other than that, it was the closest physically possible. So in Scotland, that was sometimes mountaineering. I'd be blocked maybe by cliffs or by vegetation. But and that was kind of experimental because there's no footpath there. Whereas England, maybe half of it, there's no footpath. Whereas England and Wales, it's fairly standard footpath.
Coastal footpath. And that's what, 20 meters from the sea, typically?
That's an interesting question. I would say on average, yes, but sometimes you'd have scrubland and impenetrable plants or a steep cliff, and you could be half a kilometre inland. Yeah.
And it was, you say it was 11,000 kilometres. How do you know that?
Yeah, it's sort of people think, oh, that's rounded up. But so after each walk day, when I got back home, I would plot a 1 to 25,000 scale on an ordnance survey map, even taking an account of contour lines, and added it all up. And it did come to precisely 11,000 kilometers, and I think 400 meters. Admittedly, I did sort of, because I wanted that to happen, so I did do things like walk up and down South End Pier to kind of encourage that to happen. And in Essex, I did add a few islands I wouldn't have done at the beginning. But and then interestingly, when I looked at the GPS log on my phone, it was normally 10 or 15 percent higher distance. So I'm actually, I would imagine that's probably more ultimately accurate.
Right. Okay. So why on earth did you do this, Quintin? I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, in retrospect, now it's been 10 years, it does seem crazy. And if I knew how hard it was physically and in terms of the endurance of all the editing, I'm not sure I would think I would start it. But with the naivety of excitement at the beginning, it was just inspiration of how many stories are hidden in these coastal areas where you get juxtapositions of nature, history, geology, infrastructure. I just loved all that. And I'd walked the Thames from the source to London, and that led to another walk from the source of the Severn, Britain's longest river, to the sea. And the coastal bit was probably the densest bit of inspiration I'd ever experienced in my life. And this is with my background. I traveled to 70 countries. I've been to the Arctic 3 times, the desert many times, and I tended to look for inspiration as a photographer in exotic locations. And those two journeys changed that for me, and I wanted to dedicate myself to understanding Britain. And maybe because I'm half Canadian, Britain always seems a bit weird, or the things the English, Scottish do. I've got slightly the eyes of an outsider, but I really love it and wanted to try and understand it. So that's why.
So it was 454 days of walking.
Yes.
Over 5 years.
Over 5 years, yes. That excludes kind of preparation, planning, editing, which is probably that again easily.
And you took a rest. You took breaks, didn't you?
I took breaks, yeah. So I walked in. So this project kind of paid for itself by the prints that I made, but I also earn a living as a commercial architectural photographer, and I had clients, I have a family, so I had to schedule the time. I did every leg by a train station, train in, train out. So each day I planned to walk, I had to walk. And when it was more south, I'd walk maybe a week at a time. And in Scotland, I would go as far as 2 months at a time, just because it takes 2 days to get there. And it was like the train is 300 quid to get there. So it was partly practical, and also it was also about fitness and kind of getting in the zone of doing something hard. I needed a bit of, once I was in it, it was easier to keep going.
And it was mainly rough camping.
So for a number of reasons, so every fifth day I'd stay either in a hostel, a B&B, or someone would put me up. The rest of the time I camped, and I didn't pay for a single night of camping. So that wasn't just thriftiness, although that was a factor. It was also because I felt a deep connection to the landscape, to sleep on it. And as a photographer, if I was camped by an interesting location, say the Minak Theatre, I could photograph it, which is an open air theatre in Cornwall. I could photograph it in daylight, at dusk, at night, and then the following morning. So that maximized the chance of getting a good shot.
Okay. And you certainly got some good shots.
Thank you.
So let's talk about the book a little bit. How is it organized and laid out? I mean, describe the structure and then a double page spread.
Okay, so the structure in retrospect, this was after a lot of conversation with the graphic designer and the publisher, is actually super simple. So it's like chronological, clockwise, around the coast of Britain, based on the historical counties, which are geographically smaller and more similarly sized than the modern counties. And so it just goes clockwise around the south of England, Wales, Scotland, and each chapter is proportional to the length of coastline. So a long chapter maybe has 28 pages, and a short chapter has 4. So that's hopefully a unique, interesting thing. You can like literally feel that half of the book is Scotland, which was the case. I think it was 43% of the whole journey was Scotland. So you can feel between your fingers how long the coastline is.
Wow.
And then in terms of the layout, so the book is square, all the photographs are square, and the graphic designer called Claire Skeets did a brilliant job of doing different layout templates. So there's a flow and a rhythm, which is quite different throughout the book. And what we tried to do is balance fine art pictures with pictures that are recognizable as a location, with other pictures that maybe have a bit of humor to it, and other pictures which are just purely some fascinating thing that I learned along the way. And so some pages are maybe it's full page, like 2 full-page images opposite each other that just work aesthetically, and others can have up to, I think it's 12 is the maximum, in a kind of mosaic, which work together to convey a sense of place.
The layouts are just breathtaking, you know, and the images are breathtaking, and we'll get to the images in a second, but the layout is just fantastic.
Oh, thank you.
And there's 40,000 words in this book.
Yeah, so it's a novel, and I do some sort of journalism to write words to my images. I wrote a column in a photo magazine for 4 years, so I'm not like a complete word incompetent, but this was a baptism of fire. It's the first time I've been properly edited, and so it was a kind of fascinating and difficult process. So actually it took more time to get the words in order last year when I was after the book contract was signed than getting the images together, which isn't how I thought it would be, because the images were kind of almost ready to go.
So did you record it? Did you write it down in a notebook?
So I used IA Writer on my iPhone, and then in the tent at night or as I was walking, if someone told me something funny or I saw something strange, as the moment happened, I would just write it onto my phone in sort of bullet points. And if I was feeling inspired in the tent, if I wasn't tired, which didn't happen much, I might write a couple of paragraphs. And then those formed a column in the magazine called Digital Camera. And then that formed the basis that was rewritten completely. But that was, hopefully it's all written in the first person and is kind of fresh. I mean, most of the words are remembered like in the very moment. So I hope that gives a kind of freshness to it, as a balance to the to the images. So I'm trying to say like people I met, feelings, geography, a few facts that enrich the images. And each chapter I've tried to write about maybe two or three images, so there's a synergy between the images and the writing.
Right. And when we were sort of communicating to before scheduling this podcast, you said to me that you were chuffed with the maps, that you thought they
are they're fantastic. Yeah, so that's another brilliant designer called Nikki Barnaby who designed these maps. And at the beginning she said, oh, can you choose some good maps from some of your other books? And I've got my bookshelf is all photography, geography, exploration, travel, and I thought that shouldn't be a problem. And actually when I leaf through them, they seem to either be too arty and minimalist or too kind of looking like a distressed ye olde map with too much ornament, and neither would go with the aesthetic of this book. And and we worked collaboratively to get what I think are just, I hope, is really functional but also clean and minimalist.
Absolutely.
In our mapping.
And the maps are black with the detail in white, so they're reversed from what you might expect.
And, yeah,
why'd you do that?
That was a big choice. So we had a number of iterations at the beginning, and one was, and I felt it wasn't looking specific enough to the book. And the book is, all the images are on white, and obviously the copy is on white. So the section dividers, which are the country sections, which the book is divided into five, England split into three for south, west, and east. We went for this sort of dark look. So there's a black and white photograph, very dark, and then the map dark. And I felt that it looked really stunning and broke up the book visually, but also it was clear and it made it look distinctive. And what I wanted was that the mapping should look distinctive. And Nikki really did that, I think.
Yeah. And you went with ceremonial counties. And first of all, I think we need to explain to listeners who aren't Brits what a ceremonial county is.
Yes, so it's super weird and complicated. It's actually a little more complicated than that, because you've got ceremonial and historic, which are also slightly different. So I went with a sort of historical point in time, which is about 150 years ago, where the counties were kind of proportionally sized. And it's a different story in Wales, and it's a different story in Scotland and in England. And the reason I did it was because, for example, in currently half of north of Scotland is called Highland, and then which is thousands and thousands of kilometers, whereas historically it was divided into included Caithness, Ross, Sutherland, and they're more proportionally geographically similar. And what I found in the walking was that also corresponded with different cultures, different accents, different geology. So it really made sense to group them that way. And I hope that the reader will sort of give them a key into understanding different locations of the country. But a kind of map, a currently produced map that can combine these different shires in Wales, Scotland and England, you know, it doesn't exist. No one produced it. So we had to combine various different maps from different books. And then Nikki put them in Adobe Illustrator in different layers and then worked through different layers to bring out different things with different projections. So it was quite a job. It wasn't done in a kind of GIS technical way. It was done, she used the Ordnance Survey current map as the kind of, as the background, and then these other maps were related to it.
Right. Okay. And there are 1,300 photographs in the book.
There are 1,300 photographs in the book, yes, which I was delighted and amazed when the publisher said, yeah, we want this to have a load of images, because I thought we'd end up with sort of 400 or something, and it was really affirming that they believed in that. And I didn't believe at the beginning that a page layout with as many images on a page could work without them conflicting, and I've been totally proven wrong, because that works really well. But and then that was edited down from the 127,000 that I took on the journey. So I was editing that down for my blog as I went, and I think that, and then the long list was something like 10,000, and then to the graphic designer I gave her about four or five times the number in the book, so she had different options to play around with.
Right. Okay, so let's get to it. And I know this is difficult when you've got to choose from 1,300 babies.
Yes.
But just to give our listeners a sense of some of your personal favourites, let's just talk about your favourite images to start with.
Yeah, so you asked me to sort of choose my favourite three, and actually that was really quite easy, because the top three really sort of stick in my mind the most. And the first would be, it's called Banded Clouds, A Glimpse of Wales from Somerset, and that was taken in the summer, very humid conditions on the top of Exmoor, and Exmoor is quite a high plateau with a view across to Wales, and there are these extraordinary kind of bands of cloud that run horizontally across the frame and make it look really sort of abstract, and then there's this sort of sense of mystery that you can just make out the mountains of Wales in the distance. So that's sort of the first favorite. And then the next would be in Wales of Barmouth Bridge. So this is Victorian rail bridge made of wooden construction, and it runs across the landscape kind of like a zip. And then in the background, there's Cadair Idris and the Mordac estuary, and it's all sort of misty, and then the top of the frame is sort of lost in this atmospheric grey tone. And what I love about it is it seems like the man-made and nature in real harmony. You know, you take the bridge out, it would be a lesser image. You take the mountains out, it would be a lesser image. And that sense of balance, I really loved that. And the personal story, I was waiting for my dad to arrive by train at Barmouth. So that's why I was in that position. And in fact, the photo was better without the train on the bridge, but that's why I was there at that time. And then my absolute favourite, without question, of the whole project was in Knoydart, which is in the Rough Bounds, kind of opposite Skye, northwest Scotland. So that's a very inaccessible region without many roads. And there's a tiny cottage called Skeary, which is by Loch Horn, and behind it you have this sort of wall of snowy of mist, and then you get this wall of snowy mountains. And because I took it with a telephoto, it's sort of quite compressed, and it just shows the epic scale of that region, which totally surprised me. It looks like, if you showed me that picture before the project, I would have guessed it was in Norway rather than Britain, or rather than Scotland. So those are my three favorites.
So what struck me was, having lived all my life in this country, was that these dramatic, you know, we think of this green and pleasant land, or you do if you come from the southeast.
You yes, know, you do.
We go occasionally to the Lake District, and we've been up to Scotland and, you know, holidayed in the Highlands and everything.
Yeah.
But actually, what you're showing are these dramatic, icy and misty landscapes,
yes,
which are so different to what most people think England and Scotland and Wales look like.
Yes, I mean that's my takeaway from this project. When I'm travelling in London on the tube, I kind of can't believe we're on the same piece of rock as the landscapes you're describing there. Yes, I kind of feel a connection to that. I think it's because most of those Wilder places are often on peninsulas. They may have no road or one road. So you really, the only way to experience them is to do off trail hiking to see them. I think that's probably why they're not sort of better known, if you like.
So, scary moments.
Yeah, there were a few. I think the scariest, without a doubt, was being I was stuck below the soft clay cliffs of Holderness, which are the fastest eroding. I didn't realize this at the time, which is why I was stuck. But they're the fastest eroding cliffs in Europe, so that they erode 5 to 7 meters a year, and because of that, the Ordnance Survey map has the roads running off into the sea. And there's 18 villages which have been lost over since Roman times to the sea. I didn't know any of this, so I just interpreted the map that we had roads going to the edge of a cliff, which normally means the stairs or steps going down and the tide came up and it was dark and the water was lapping over my boots, and I was trying to climb up this cliff. I mean, it was only 30 meters, but it was very steep and it was soft, so my feet sunk into this clay, like kind of wet concrete, so it was truly terrifying. And then I noticed that it was about 10 meters lower, 20 meter cliff, a bit further along, and by a miracle, it was more like kind of garden soil, so I could get some traction and clamber up. But by the, when I got to the top of the cliff, I laid on my back. It was just this surge of adrenaline. And this was quite near the end of the journey, and I was munching an Eccles cake I just bought, and it felt with zero risk. So it was kind of ironic, really. I suppose my guard was down. I just didn't realize this interesting geographical thing there, that how quickly it's eroding.
That's Norfolk or Suffolk?
No, that's East Yorkshire. It's a similar thing in Suffolk and Norfolk. So those are the three regions where, as you well know, it's very highly eroding. But actually, the fastest bit is Norfolk. Is Holderness, and I think it's because there's the stabilisation works on the towns there, which has actually meant the longshore drift going up is more extreme. So it's actually increased the erosion in the areas next to it.
So another one, scary.
So it'd be following the Broomway. So that's classified as the UK's most dangerous path, which is a tidal route to the island of Foulness. Over the years, I believe it's claimed over 100 lives, and that's because the tides come in very, very fast. And it's affected not only by the tide, but also by the air pressure, the speed. There's sinking mud and sand on one side, and because it's a military training area, there's unexploded ordnance on the other side. So you have to, you have to really get everything aligned, and you have to navigate perfectly. And normally it's only done with a guide. And I couldn't, what I wanted to do, which was to walk onto it, walk around the island and walk back, I couldn't find a guide that would do that, because the extreme tourist trip is you get a guide on the island, you stop for half an hour or something, and then you go back, and the timing's for me. So I wanted to walk out on one tide and back on another tide. So I did quite a bit of research, talked to some people that did it, and then did it myself. But it meant like walking as you walk as the tide. So you walk with your boots splashing as the tide is falling. And for me, that was at 5 a.m. And it's this weirdest sensation, because it's a kilometer offshore. And it's like mirrored of the sky and the sea, just the whole thing is a mirror, and you're sort of walking, you're not quite sure where you're going to step. Is you're suddenly going to plunge into some sort of weird morass. And I sort of felt my way with trekking poles, but that was a sort of surge of adrenaline the entire time. And then when I got to the island, I sort of collapsed on the beach, and then these burly security guys, because it's a military training area, sort of come up and sort of ask me what I'm doing, and I say, oh, I'm just coming to walk around the island. And then they sort of said, all right, fill your boots, mate. And it was just like, they obviously didn't see many people do that. But it's a very strange feeling on the island of being very watched. And like the pub is boarded up and closed down, and the church is boarded up and closed down. And it's sort of mysterious, ambiguous stuff going on there.
But once you're on the island, if you miss the time to come back, you can stay overnight, presumably. It wasn't totally crazy.
It wasn't totally, I mean, it would be an issue because the security patrols there would come up and ask you what you're doing. It's a weird compromise because there is a footpath network, but yet there's no public access off that. So you're kind of, and you can't, there is a bridge onto the island, but you can't get to that bridge without crossing a checkpoint. I imagine in an emergency, you could go and the soldiers would check and ask and see what you're doing and you could leave. But so that's the weird compromise of Foulness Island. Yeah, it's a very, very strange place.
And one that was scary funny, I think, was Hartlepool.
Oh, yeah, Hartlepool. Yeah, I was camped by Hartlepool nuclear power station because...
As one does.
No, I tell you, there was a reason, because Ridley Scott was a child there, and the opening scene of Blade Runner, he was inspired by all the chemical works and the flare stacks at the opening of that movie, and I love all that kind of stuff. I wanted to balance infrastructure and beautiful landscape in the book. So I was there with my tripod taking loads of pictures at night of those flare stacks, which happens to be next to the power station. And again, I wanted to get the pictures in the morning, and I went to sleep thinking everything was fine. And then I had this unusually assertive good morning right outside my tent, opened the tent, and these two armed nuclear police were standing over me, wanting to know what the hell I was doing. And once they were reassured, it was all, you know, there's nothing nefarious was going on. They were really good natured, and we got these kind of quite amusing tents of them looking really badass, guarding my tiny tent. So that was a scary, quickly funny moment. Yeah.
And let's finish this talking about the photos. There's some really funny pictures as well in the book, aren't there?
I mean, partly a long walk like this, you need to kind of make your own entertainment after didn't see anyone for 4 or 5 days at a time. So the kind of the passive aggressive signs and the quirkiness of the English and the make do and mend thing, which I kind of love and is funny, I was particularly drawn to those things that would make me chuckle. And at Bawdsey Quay, I saw a tiny camper van, which had a mock Tudor wooden, it had been painted like a mock Tudor camper van. And I just thought this was the most English thing I'd ever seen. And I kind of walked past this guy and sitting reading outside. And at one point his wife, I assume, hands a bacon butty outside that he takes silently and starts munching it. And I just loved that moment. And then in right far up in the Highlands in Wester Ross, there was this very improvised, like a tiny shelf, and it said on it hats, gloves, etc. And it was it sort of looked like a Highland department store. And then behind it, there was the bleakest, most desolate landscape you could imagine. And you're sort of thinking, what does etc. mean? Yeah.
Yeah, I love those tables where there's stuff put out and you just... You have to be honest and pay for what you take, and
that's right.
And they
yeah.
work in those places. They do. Absolutely work.
They do. And then the final thing on that, I saw actually near that nuclear power station we were just talking about near Teesside, there was a gate, and it was locked, and it said no access, and then it had all these hazard warning signs. And then, but yet you could just walk around the gate. So it was some kind of weird health and safety thing that they decided. It wasn't that the job hadn't been finished. It was some access to some sluice, but it seemed very, very English that all this unnecessary infrastructure had been created with all this signage where you could just walk around it.
So a lot of your pictures, I mean, that one you saw it, you thought, I've got to take that picture. But there are a lot of pictures which I'm guessing... You had to really think through what time you wanted to be up or taking the picture, where you were going to position yourself. I mean, it's not just like most of us with a phone camera and we see something and we click a few shots and then pick the best one.
Yeah. I suppose there's two types of photo. The one is what you're describing, where I'd use an app called the Photographer's Ephemeris, where it plots the moon and the sunrise, so you can kind of get a good impression what side of a landmark to be on to get the good light. And there was sometimes planning like that, but that was more often than not, if I was camped somewhere, I would use that to maximize where I was spending some time. I mean, most of these pictures in this book were based on serendipity of arriving somewhere interesting where the light was good. Now, if that happened, I would go hog wild and I'd take sometimes hundreds of pictures. So my methodology, if I found somewhere that was interesting, I would experiment without any preconception of what would work, with different focal lengths, different camera angles, different camera positions. A bit, I see it like sketching almost. You're getting to understand the subject, and maybe after 10 minutes, after maybe taking 100 frames, which incidentally I could immediately bin in the editing room because they were nearly all bad, I got to understand the subject as how it looked through the camera, and then the good pictures started to come and I could be a bit more considered. So that was the process where nearly all these pictures are taken. It was like the tail end of experimental photography. Right. And that's why there's such the crazy number of pictures that I took. And actually, when I'm editing it, those 90%, the first ones, I can immediately bin because they were just a means to understanding what I was looking at.
Gotcha. So you've walked the whole of Britain. Some geographic thoughts or observations on this walk?
Well, I think, like we were talking about with the ceremonial counties, I really felt that the character of the people and the landscape and the geology are in and some slightly mysterious sort of way that it's hard to sort of understand with logic seemed to be aligned. So it felt like you'd sort of flow from one clan of people that was very distinctive and deeply proud of their landscape with a very specific set of geographical conditions, and then you'd immediately move to another one. And that's what made walking this so fascinating, because each of those sections and feelings, it never lasted more than a few days, so it was never boring. It was constantly varied. And specific surprises, I would think, like on the Ardnamurchan Peninsula, which is the westernmost point of the mainland Britain, you know, there's a caldera of a volcano, which you can see in satellite clearly, and you can, it's a large kind of ridge, remains of the volcano. And I had no idea something like that existed in Britain. Like things like, many islands like Eilean and Donnan on the west coast are they, I think they're magma intrusions left from volcanoes. So it is volcanic, but I had no idea that those were sort of readable by the eye. So that was really strange. And then I suppose the overarching thing would be just how much more rugged the west coast is to the east. I think that's geological because of the landmass have tilted, and I think there's more sediment on the east and more. I'm not an expert, but you get exposed granite on the west, and it's just very rugged and indented, and that's why there are all the headlands. And then the other big surprise was the erosion in Holderness and all those villages lost to time.
Yeah. So this has been a 10-year endeavor.
Yes. Kristen. Yes.
From starting to publication. What's next?
Well,
loads of architectural photography?
There's been some, yes. I mean, I've been kind of putting food on the table with that. I mean, that's kind of a consistent thing, and selling prints from this project is the other way that I kind of keep doing these weird things. But the physical side of the walk ended 5 years ago, so to be happy and excited, I need to feel that in the next few weeks I'm going to be sleeping in my tent in somewhere beautiful. So I'd walked all 16 national trails of Britain since the perimeter was finished, and I finished that about 2 years ago. And then my current project is walking up and camping on top where I can all the mountains of England and Wales, and there's 442 of them. and that's super fun. It's because I'm not really a list ticker, although it might seem like that. Because why I love these list based things is it's just an excuse to visit somewhere interesting, and it's what you're going to see on the way there. So, say recently I was up at up in the northern Pennines and across Fell, and it was sort of, there was ice on the tent, and it was kind of strangely Arctic conditions, and it was all the different things that I saw on the way. It's like putting a chain of different mountains together, and I did it in the same style as the perimeter, so train and carrying a few days food, photography, and so that's what's next.
And then maybe Ireland?
Yes. I think my dream would be, because I just didn't realize the perimeter would absorb 10 years of my life, but what I would love to do is do the islands in Ireland. I think that'd be a really lovely follow-on project to this. It's, I think it would probably almost end up the same length with the amount of islands there are. I haven't done the sums yet, and possibly with some kind of kayaking method of getting between them. That really inspires me, but we'll see. That's like that's the future plan.
Sounds scary.
Yeah.
So wrapping up, people can reach you. Well, first of all, the book's released on the 15th of May.
Yes, it's on the 15th of May, so you can get it everywhere, Amazon, bookshop.org, and most high street retailers.
And you've got launch events at the Bath Festival on the 20th of May?
That's right, yes. I'm giving an illustrated talk at Bath Festival, 20th of May. The launch is at Stanford's in London on the 21st of May, although that's sold out. I'm talking at the Festival of Outdoor Photography on the 31st of May. That's at the Royal Geographical Society. And then at Hatchard's at Cheltenham on the 12th of June. And then at Borders Book Festival in Scotland on the 14th of June.
Wow. So still a lot of travelling to do.
Yes, well, I love all that. Yes, it's the talking in front of a crowd that is a little bit more scary.
Well, and if people want to reach out to you, they can find you at Quintin Lake on Instagram, Blue Sky, and you're still on X.
I've got this.
It's right. You don't have to apologise.
No, but I do because I've only recently joined Blue Sky, and it's such a lovely, friendly. It's like X Twitter was 10 years ago. But this book was actually born of. A lot of it was on X. It was the friends and the contacts I made there, the generous advice people put me up. That all happened in X. So I'm loath to leave it. But I mean, I think most of those people seem to have gone to Blue Sky now. So,
and if anybody wants to have a look at some of your photos and even order a print from you, they can do that at theperimeter.uk.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. And all of that stuff is in the show notes, everybody. So go and have a look. Quintin, it's been absolutely fantastic. I'm in awe of your courage, your endurance, and your beautiful photography, of course. And thank you very much for being on the GeoMob podcast.
Oh, thanks so much, Stephen. It's been great to talk to you.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for joining us today on the GeoMob podcast. We hope you enjoyed the discussion. You can get the show notes over on the website, which is at thegeomob.com. And while you're there, you can sign up for our monthly newsletter and find links to our accounts on Mastodon and LinkedIn, so that you can stay up to date on all our upcoming events. We hope to see you at an event soon.